Invite you now into a time of meditation and reflection. And I invite you, as you're comfortable doing so, to close your eyes, to relax into your chair. Take a couple of deep breaths. Share with you the words of John O'Donohue, a poem titled "For Someone Who Did You Wrong." Though its way is to strike in a dumb rhythm, stroke upon stroke, as though the heart were an anvil, the hurt you sent had a mind of its own. Something in you knew exactly how to shape it, to hit the target, slipping into the heart through some wound window left open since childhood. While it struck outside, it burrowed inside, made tunnels through every ground of confidence for days. It would lie still until a thought would start it. Meanwhile, you forgot, went on with things, and never even knew how that perfect shape of hurt continued to work. Now a new kindness seems to have entered time, and I can see how that hurt has schooled my heart in a compassion I otherwise never would have learned. Somehow now, I have begun to glimpse the unexpected fruit your dark gift had planted, and I thank you for your unknown work. I have to confess that this was a bit of a difficult sermon to write. There are issues around religious liberty, conscience, that aren't easily reconciled in our society. So these are my words. Take them as you will. Something I wrestle with, still wrestle with, still have no firm answers to. Do you remember Jiminy Cricket? Jiminy Cricket, for those of you who may not know who Jiminy Cricket is, had the job of being Pinocchio's conscience in the Disney version of the classic Italian fairy tale, The Adventures of Pinocchio. And in the movie, Jiminy Cricket is adorable. He's cute, he's kind, he sings. He's the perfect embodiment of the Disneyfied version of conscience in American popular culture. Because conscience is that still small voice that tells you right from wrong. And we all know right from wrong, good from bad, cool from kind, right? But if we know all these things, then why do we need a conscience at all? We should note that in the original story, Pinocchio is not particularly bright. His head is made of wood, after all. He is not cute and cuddly. He's selfish and willful. And the talking cricket is a constant nagging presence, a nudge, as we say. And Pinocchio smashes him with a hammer pretty on it early on in the story. But that's the way it was with these old teaching stories. They didn't pull any punches. But how many of us have squashed that little voice in our hearts? Conscience is that still small voice that people won't listen to, Jiminy tells Pinocchio. Now the cricket, the talking cricket, comes back later in the original story, but as a ghost. An insubstantial being incapable of enforcing its will. And so we see all these images of people with an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other whispering in their ears, as our popular imagination would say it, illustrate it. And of course the angel is telling them to do good or not to do something bad. And the little devil is urging them to ignore the angel. Let your conscience be your guide, sang Jiminy Cricket. But conscience is not always consistent or reliable, and it too suffers from all kinds of biases. Telling right from wrong and good from bad and cruelty from kindness is not always easy. Because between the two, in our head and our hearts, is that vast gray area called it depends. And then there are desires, needs, and fears as well. So what is a conscience? Where does it come from and why does it matter? Because like a lot of things, when you start digging into it, the very idea of conscience is a little bit amorphous. And we could spend days delving into the history of the idea and its evolution as a concept, and we still wouldn't really arrive at any kind of firm definition. Socrates relied on an inner daemon, a divine spark, that warned him when he was about to make a mistake. Christian Europe saw conscience as the voice of God within, a moral source that was inherent in all human beings as a result of their creation in God's image. Buddhism associates conscience with a pure heart and a calm, well-directed mind. It's regarded as a spiritual power and as one of the guardians of the world. Those are just a few examples. Conscience appears throughout the religions of the world, something sourced from some greater power, some divine energy. Now, more secular schools of thought see conscience as arising from evolutionary pressures on group behavior. What's right and wrong is therefore shaped by our upbringing, by our religious and cultural mores. And so as children grow up, they're constantly bombarded with messages about how to behave and what is permitted and what is forbidden. And sometimes those messages are accompanied by threats of punishment from divine sources, or the withholding of love and affection, or of being ostracized. Conscience can be an ugly business. But whatever its source, it is conscience that helps keep us in line with the moral judgment of those around us. A couple of quotes here. Conscience is the inner voice that warns us that someone may be looking. H.L. Mencken. Conscience in most people is but the anticipation of the opinions of others. Jeremy Taylor. Now, Marilynne Robinson wrote this. I assume that conscience is a human trait widespread enough to be generally characteristic, not originating in culture, but inevitably modified by it. Guilt and shame, and dread at the thought of incurring them, are clearly associated with conscience, which grants them legitimacy and which they empower. And she goes on to say, conversely, the belief that one's actions are endorsed by conscience can inspire a willingness to stand against custom or consensus in matters that might otherwise be considered wrong or shameful. For example, rebellion against the existing order. A willingness to stand against custom or consensus. Rebellion against the existing order. Those are key phrases for us today. Freedom of conscience and thought is at the root of our religious heritage as Unitarian Universalists. One of the great social struggles in the Middle Ages was between dissident religious movements and the established church. And the core of the issue was whether people had a right to their own beliefs. And bloody wars and inquisitions that lasted for centuries were the result of that struggle. And eventually the people won, or rather competing church-state monopolies of power arose. But more recently, our faith springs from the dissenting tradition, which arose in England as a widespread movement against state involvement in religious matters, against the church-state axis of power. There were quite a number of years when England went from being Catholic to Protestant with the changes of kings and queens. This tradition, this dissenting tradition, had earlier roots in Puritan theology, which gave primacy to the internal authority of the self informed by reason. Reason in the sense that things make sense, not just a rigid rationality. Reason itself was seen as a gift from God, because how else could we achieve salvation but through our own efforts? And unless our salvation was freely chosen, it was meaningless, because otherwise we were puppets. I want to quote something from a little book called The Unitarian Contribution to Social Progress in England. It was written by a man named Raymond Holt, published in London in 1938. For if men are to be freed from reliance on external authority, they must be educated to be independent in judgment. And if men are to be responsible citizens, they must be given knowledge. And the dissonant struggle to achieve that was neither easy nor bloodless. Men, women, and children were tortured, killed for their beliefs, maimed or mutilated, having noses cut off and ears clipped were popular punishment, deported, sent into servitude or slavery. Many fled to America, seeking the freedom to live in accordance with their beliefs. English humanist lawyers in the 16th and 17th centuries interpreted conscience as a collection of universal principles given to man by God at creation to be applied by reason. And so, for the first time, the dictates of one conscience could be claimed as a mitigating factor for one's actions. And this laid the legal and moral groundwork for conscientious objectors, for civil disobedience, for conscientious non-compliance to customs and laws and policies that individuals considered to be unjust. Conscience has always been the driver of human rights activism, from the abolition of slavery to the condemnation of genocide to the peace movements to animal rights activism and so much more. And ultimately, conscience became enshrined in international law. The United Nations Universal Declaration on Human Rights, which is part of international customary law, specifically refers to conscience in Articles 1 and 18. Article 1 states, "All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood." Article 18 says, "Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. And this right includes freedom to change his or her religion or belief, and freedom, either alone or in community with others, and in public or in private, to manifest his religion in belief, in teaching, in practice, in worship, and observance." I relate this history for several reasons. One is to illustrate how deeply grounded in the past our faith is. We may seem like the new kid on the block, but we go way back. And to also to show the sources for several of our principles, most notably the first and the fifth. Another is that we might look at this past as a guide as we navigate the present. Another is to acknowledge that I think that this process, this long and difficult flowering of freedom of thought, belief, and conscience is in trouble. And I think this freedom is in trouble because the competing interest groups in our society no longer seem to be able to grant other groups the authenticity of their beliefs. To engage in reasoned discourse concerning their differences, to find and live with the compromises that living in a complex and diverse society demands. I must confess that I don't feel much joy or any thrill of victory when I hear that the Oregon couple who declined to bake a wedding cake for a lesbian wedding had to close their business. They had a $135,000 fine levied against them. Their bank accounts were seized. They had a checking account with a few hundred bucks in it and $7,000 in savings. The state threatened to take away their children until the parents were rehabilitated. This isn't Oregon. They have been targeted with hate mail and social media messages wishing things like, "Your children get sick and die." And death threats like, "We're sneaking in the back door with a gun drawn to take you out of this world." Now, I'm quite sure that they were utterly insufferable when they declined to bake the cake, quoting scripture and being righteously judgmental about the lives of the lesbian couple to their very faces. They were hateful. They were not nice. And the hurt feelings that resulted were far more significant than simply not being able to purchase a cake. And I don't condone their act of discrimination. But neither do I condone what I consider to be a storm that rained down upon them. Because it feels disproportionate. It feels unreasonable that their business has been destroyed, that their lives are stalked by fear, because they chose not to bake a cake for something that they don't support. And the scale of the response just feels biblical. like really old school, burn the village and salt the earth, like as a warning to other people kind of a thing? And why? Because I don't see any winners. I don't see anything resembling restorative justice. I see no redemption. I see no salvation. I see no healing of relationships. And such actions turn our society into a battleground. They don't admit any nuance or complexity, multiplicity of views. They harden hearts, and they make the way forward more difficult. A zero-sum game where everyone loses. It creates enemies of the secular humanism that has brought us so much in the way of a free and open society. Our religious heritage stood with the common people against too much involvement of the state in religious matters, against the power of the state to compel obedience, to forbid or endorse beliefs or actions. And yes, I realize there's a quick conflict between civil rights and religious rights, and that it's not an easy thing to navigate. But for us in particular, from the dissenting tradition, to invoke the terrible power of the state is fraught with moral peril. For us, the danger is that we become what we've fought all these years. Our fifth principle commits us to the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process. Within our congregations and in society at large, the Reverend Parisa Parsa, Executive Director of the Public Conversations Project, wrote this about the fifth principle. In our religious lives, the democratic process requires trust in the development of each individual conscience, a belief that such development is possible for each of us, as well as a commitment to cultivate our own conscience. We could call it a commitment to the value of each person. In the words of Theodore Parker, democracy means not, I am as good as you are, but you are as good as I am. And my connection with the sacred is only as precious as my willingness to acknowledge the same connection in others. So the question is, can we truly allow that those we disagree with, even those we might consider unevolved, unawoke, fundamentalist, conservative, even those we might consider to be ignorant and uninformed, can we truly allow that they too have a right to freedom of conscience, to freedom from coercion? Because our sense of conscience demands that we acknowledge that other people have consciences too. And that whether we agree with them or not, they have some fundamental right to their positions and a right to live their lives in accordance with the dictates of their consciences. And that's what makes us different. And I believe that makes our way a better way. But it's a hard way. For our faith to be meaningful, we must persuade and not compel. We must trust that we can awaken conscience in others through connection with the sacred, however they may conceive that. Persuading other people and arriving at compromises when persuasion fails has long been one of the hallmarks of democracy. And balancing competing rights is a long and sometimes excruciating process whose outcomes we may not always like or agree with, we may not always get our way. Creating the world our conscience envisions requires us to get power and to wield power gracefully and democratically, causing as little harm as possible, even if we have been harmed. This is the difficult work of democracy and our liberal heritage, our religious heritage. And to abandon it is to risk the return to the bloody days of those religious wars. And there are those who would like nothing better. And we cannot play into their hands. There are difficult days of struggle before us, and how we struggle matters. We must show grace, even when none is revealed to us. We must show mercy, even when none is given to us. We must be compassionate, even when hearts are hardened against us. And we must be generous, whether in defeat or in victory. Some will see this as weakness, but we will know it as strength and carry on. Amen. Shalom and blessed be. May it be so. Our closing words come to us today from the Irish poet Seamus Heaney. The poem is titled, From the Republic of Conscience. When I landed in the Republic of Conscience, it was so noiseless that when the engine stopped, I could hear a curlew high above the runway. At immigration, the clerk was an old man who produced a wallet from his homespun coat and showed me a photograph of my grandfather. The woman in customs asked me to declare the words of our traditional cures and charms to heal dumbness and divert the evil eye. No porters, no interpreter, no taxi. You carried your own burden, and very soon your symptoms of creeping privilege disappeared. Fog is a dreaded omen there, but lightning spells universal good, and parents hang swaddled infants in trees during thunderstorms. Salt is their precious mineral, and seashells are held to the ear during births and funerals. The base of all inks and pigments is seawater. Their sacred symbol is a stylized boat. The sail is an ear, the mast a sloping pen, the hull a mouth shape, the keel an open eye. At their inauguration, public leaders must swear to uphold unwritten law and weep to atone for their presumption to hold office. And to affirm their faith that all life sprang from salt in tears, which the sky god wept after he dreamt his solitude was endless. I came back from that frugal republic with my two arms the one length, the customs woman having insisted my allowance was myself. The old man rose and gazed into my face and said that was official recognition that I was now a dual citizen. He therefore desired me when I got home to consider myself a representative and to speak on their behalf in my own tongue. Their embassies, he said, were everywhere, but operated independently, and no ambassador would ever be relieved.